you like movies? Then Netflix is the place for you. Would you like to support this podcast? Use the red stamp-shaped Netflix affiliate banner link in the show notes at TruckerTomPodcast.com for a free trial and instantly begin streaming movies right to your computer or TV set-top box.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Tango Tango Papa 1469, February 19, 2011.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Cuba, Missouri. I came back to work today. I left, I guess it was around, 10:45 when I left home. And had to pick a load up over in Tulsa. I ended up getting there, I guess it was about 1:45 when I got there. And when I got to the place where I picked the load up at, and the loading appointment was at 2:15, and so they got me backed into the dock, and I think it was around pushing 4 o'clock whenever I left there. It was around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then so I've made it here to Rolla, Missouri, and that leaves me... I think when I looked at my GPS, I think it's a little under 500 miles, 400 and something, you know, almost 500 miles to drive tomorrow. And the load delivers in Springfield, Ohio on Sunday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. So should be able to easily drive the remaining distance tomorrow, which is Saturday, and then we'll be there and then go to deliver the load Sunday morning. So very nice day today. It was probably, I'm guessing it was about 75 degrees today. Well, I think that's what my truck's thermometer said when I was moving, and it's pretty accurate. And so it was just a gorgeous day. You know, of course, those days happen from time to time. In the winter, you'll get a really nice day here and there. And, today was just absolutely gorgeous. So, now here at Rolla, Missouri this evening, it's 49 degrees. So it's not bad, not as bad as it could be. But it's, we're still in February and... not out of the woods yet as far as winter weather goes. I fully expect more cold weather and more snow. That's going to happen. Because it typically happens in March, and it can even happen in April from time to time. So winter is not over yet. So anyway, before I want to talk about all the stuff that's going on in Wisconsin and some other, it's kind of spreading to some other states. But before I do that, want to talk about Peikoff.com, P-E-I-K-O-F-F.com. Leonard Peikoff has a podcast there that he hosts. He's had it for several years at this point. And he answers questions that are submitted to him through the website. And he gives advice and answers these questions using the philosophy of Ayn Rand's objectivism. And and of course, you can also find that on iTunes. Type in P-E-I-K-O-F-F in iTunes, and you'll find the long form of the podcast. Otherwise, if you just look on peacock.com, you'll find the shorter, just some shorter questions and answers there. You know, what you can get it in whichever form you want. And then, of course, on his website, he's also got where he's promoted books that he's written, and a lot of the Ayn Rand philosophy, Ayn Rand materials. He's in charge. Ayn Rand left Leonard Peikoff rights to all of her books, and so he's kind of in charge of the continued publication of her books and so on and so forth, and her continuing legacy and the continuing influence of her philosophy. So but check that out, peikoff.com, peikoff.com. and as I mentioned in the podcast last night, they are to release a movie version. It's called Atlas Shrugged Part 1 on April 15. And I played the trailer for Atlas Shrugged Part 1 in yesterday's podcast. As I said, the movie really looks great. And it's going to... Atlas Shrugged does a superb job. It really does a superb job of sort of explaining Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism, but that's the primary function of the novel, is to sort of explain objectivism as opposed to the story itself. The story itself is very entertaining, very interesting story, very entertaining. And as I've said before, many of the things that happen in the many of the plot elements, or not necessarily the plot elements, but how she sort of develops the characters in conjunction with the government and so on and so forth, that seems to be happening to us today. And some of it is very prescient. So, with what's going on today, and how government kind of ends up getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it kind of stifles real innovation, so on and so forth. And as I said before, that movie is coming out at a just perfect timing with what's going on. Now, what's going on in Wisconsin? The past couple of days, all that's going on in Wisconsin, Wisconsin, like a bunch of other states, including New Jersey, elected, you know, Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey, the people of New Jersey, you know, big liberal eastern state, known for its corruption, New Jersey's been long known for its ties to organized crime, certainly because it's right there, sort of an unfortunate bedroom community for New York City. Certain elements from New York City, it's just right across the river. New Jersey has had a long history of corruption, especially in the 20th century. And so the people of New Jersey got fed up finally, and they elected Chris Christie, and he promised to he's a Republican, promised to get rid, just clean the thing out, and you know, just really straighten the state up. And he's doing it, and he is confronting the labor unions and their unreasonable demands. The state just they couldn't pay for it anymore. The people of the state of New Jersey just couldn't pay for all of the graft and corruption that was going on. It's been going on for all these years, and it's gotten worse and worse and worse, to the point, there's always a tipping point. There's a point at which you can't continue to afford stuff. And New Jersey was at that point, and the rest of the country now is at that point. So in November, you know, the, of course, the what made a lot of press was the fact that so many, you know, the Republicans took over the Congress, or the Senate, or I'm sorry, the House. They didn't take over the Senate. They made gains in the Senate, but they really took over the House, U.S. House of Representatives. But what didn't really make much news was that the Republican sweep or conservative sweep, because it really was a conservative sweep, took place in state houses and county governments all across the country. There was a massive sweep of Republicans kind of taking over the ousting Democrats that had been in those lower political positions for years and years and years all across the country. And people in many states and jurisdictions have had enough. People, we see what's happening. Our country has no future if things continue the way they are. We cannot print money this way. We cannot spend money this way. It's not sustainable. And so what's happening now in Wisconsin, the governor there is doing what he, just like Chris Christie in New Jersey, the governor in Wisconsin is simply doing what the people elected him to do. And he's attempting to kind of straighten things out and balance the budget. You know, the state, unlike the federal government, states do not have printing presses. They can't print money that they don't have. And so to make up for shortfalls. And so, you know, it's like with me. I can't continue to spend more money than I'm making. If I do that, and I continue to do it, at some point, pretty quickly, I'm going to be in big trouble. I can't do that. And so these labor unions in Wisconsin are just going crazy, trying, you know, they're threatening the governor. Basically, somebody's making innuendos that the governor's not safe. They fear for his safety. Well, what does that mean? Is he receiving assassination attempts from union thugs? What happened to this civility that everyone, or, you know, that Obama and all the Democrats were, and the media were calling for about a month ago or so? When that idiot that should have been in a mental institution in Arizona shot the Democrat congresswoman from Arizona? You know, here they were. Oh, we have to be civil. We have to get along, and so on and so forth. Well, what about what's happening now in Wisconsin? You've got a bunch of union thugs, sort of parading around, and of course they're being bussed in. The Democrat Party is bussing them in. President Obama is, trying to whip up the unions, whip up their anger, get them mad. As if that's going to deter the governor, as if that's going to back things off, and people will be intimidated by the unions, and then we'll just continue. You know, the people in Wisconsin will continue to pay their outrageous salaries. Did you realize that teachers in Wisconsin? I saw this article just a while. Their average salary is over $100,000 a year. Let me bring that up. I've got the article. Let's see if I can find it. But their salaries are $100,000 a year. And here they are, all they have to do is maybe pay part of their retirement and pay some of their benefits, their own benefits. And we can't do that. You know, what about the people that are paying their salaries? How many people have been laid off in Wisconsin? How many people at work, and, you know, just normal people that don't work for the government, how many of those people have, you know, the employer paying for their entire, paying for all the benefits, paying for their entire retirement plan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Probably not very many. So let me see here. Okay, Wisconsin governor not going to be bullied or intimidated. Orders state troopers to bring Democrats to Capitol. There is fear for Scott Walker's safety. Scott Walker is the governor. Democrat senator will stay away for weeks. Walkout. Milwaukee schools closed. Teachers call in sick. Report. Average city teacher compensation tops $100,000. Now, I can tell you, I don't make $100,000. I don't even make half of that per year. How many people, just average people that are not government employees in Wisconsin, are making over $100,000 a year? Probably not that many. DNC, that's the Democrat National Committee, playing a role in the protests. Union fight heats up. Republicans vow to cut spending in state capitals. Protests spread to Ohio, Michigan, coming to Minnesota. Idaho official target of threats over education reform plan. Obama backs union uproar. Well, of course he does. Of course Obama backs union uproar. So, have at it. You know, if you sympathize with unions, have at it. Show us who you are. Show us who you really are. Show us your parasitic nature. These people are freeloaders. I'm sorry, but they're freeloaders. They're parasites. Who's paying their salaries? People that make half of what they make are paying their salaries, are paying these bloated salaries. And these people are like little whiny kids that the parents have spoiled them. We've all seen kids like this, where the parents have spoiled. They've got every Xbox and iPod and God knows what else, PlayStations. They've got everything you can possibly imagine. And typically they're, just imagine a fat, bloated kid there sitting there with, you know, a popsicle dangling out of their mouth playing with their video game. You know, kind of a little slob. You know, and the parents are spoiling them, you know, just parking them in front of the television, spoiling the heck out of them. And then, you know, if the parent has to cut them off, the parent can't keep paying, then, or they cut up, you know, they're even threatened with cutting them off. You know, the kid, you know, just starts screaming and whining and moaning and groaning. You know, we've seen them all in the supermarket checkout line. You know, where they start grabbing at things.
I want this, I want that.
You know, so these people need to be cut off. And, you know, I'm sorry. You know, there's a lot of people that, that are getting some kind of government check. You know, and too bad. Reality is reality. We're out of money at this point. You know, we've been out of money for a while, and now we're soon going to be out of credit. You know, and by the way, the inflation's kicking in. You know, remember the $700 billion or $800 billion or whatever it was, and you know, everybody warned, there's going to be inflation for after this, and you know, and you know, so it's not a surprise. It shouldn't come as a surprise. Well, it's kicking in now. You know, you can't print money this way. You can't, you know, continue to borrow and do what they've done without consequence. There are fewer people working now than there were a couple of years ago. You have fewer people working, and of course they've borrowed more money. Just look at the debt there, you know, look at the deficit. Forget about the debt, look at the deficit. The deficit, you know, this is unsustainable. It's absolutely unsustainable. And the country's about to go off a cliff. It really is. And I think a lot of people realize this. So go ahead, you know, the union people, show us who you really are. Throw your little temper tantrums. Have at it. Because at this point, there's a whole lot more of us than there are of you. Look at what happened in the last election. There's a whole lot more of us than there are of you. And there isn't much sympathy in the circles that I travel in. There isn't much sympathy for unions. You know, I've never had much sympathy for unions, and I could care less about the collective bargaining argument. The problem I have with unions is the political affiliation. Why are they always affiliated with kooky liberal, you know, scum? You know, the union leaders are typically always scum. Somehow the scum always rises to the top. Why is the president associated with unions? You know, why are so many Democrats associated with unions? Why do unions always back, you know, liberals? You know, there's something rotten. There's just something wrong, something rotten about labor unions. In many cases. Not all of them, but in many cases. And I would much rather not be a part of any kind of a union. I would much rather just work for, you know, just have an at-will type of thing where I work for a company and they can fire me for any reason. If I misperform or whatever, you know, whatever the reason, they can fire me if they want to. And conversely, I can quit if I want to, too. But I would much rather be in a voluntary sort of position where I, you know, it's where I don't have people, you know, all these rules and you know, strings kind of tying me into something, you know, and all this psychological, you know, because in large part, you know, where it's as if, you know, it, you know, I've asked this question before. Can you, apart from the buildings, can you show me where the government is? It really, it's only a figment of our imaginations. It only exists in our minds. It's a control, sort of a control that exists in our minds. Well, where's the labor union? Can you show me where it's at? It only exists to the extent that people believe it exists. And so it's a form of slavery. It's just a different form of slavery. Is all it is. You know, the government, the Department of United States Department of Transportation has announced they're going to have new trucking rules. They're going to come out with new rules, and these new rules are going to really, they're going to have the effect of tightening down the screws more, you know, because this is a difficult job, and not, it's a difficult enough job as it is. With you know, they've got this 14-hour rule where if I start my day, I have to end it 14 hours later, even if I've sat all day and done nothing while I'm waiting at a ship or a receiver. Because of the economy, you know, virtually every load now is, you know, is just in time, and they only allow so much time. Well, they're going to tighten those rules even farther. And they're going to make the job that much more difficult. And they're not, they say, oh, we're doing this for safety. We want the roads to be safe. Oh, no, they don't. They could care less about safety. You know, and the ones that are the useful idiots that do think that they care about safety, they've never driven, they've never even probably gotten their damn fingernails dirty. They've never worked for a living. You know, they live in some kind of academic dream world. You know, some theoretical world where they're self-important. You know, and they dream up all these rules for other people to follow. What they really want to do, the people that are pushing these new rules, and they'll go into effect regardless. You know, there's a 60-day or 90-day comment period, you know, you can comment all you want. They're going to do what they want because it's a dictatorship. They're going to do what they want. They're not going to, they'll take the comments or whatever, but they're going to do whatever they want. So I fully expect them to implement these new rules, you know, that kind of make the job even tougher and reduce people's reduce my income and reduce other people's income is one of the effects it's going to have. What they really want to do is they want to make the job so tough, they want to disrupt things so much that maybe they think, well, if we can really disrupt this and make this tough, then these, you know, maybe the truck drivers will be more receptive to the idea of a labor union. That's what they want. That's what they think. Guarantee you, someone thinks that. Probably Obama. And, you know, this Ray LaHood that's in charge of the Department of Transportation. These people need to, you know, and of course Ray LaHood's a bureaucrat. These people need to be ousted. They need to be drummed out of government. The government needs shrunk down. Get rid of all these people. They don't really do anything. What do? They're just parasites. They're freeloaders. They don't produce anything. We need to get rid of them. You know, and they can scream and moan and groan all they want. I don't care. I'm the one paying their damn salary. You know, if you pay taxes, you know, and of course the government, you know, the government employees, well, I pay taxes. Yeah, but where does your money come from? You're not producing anything. You're a parasite. I'm sorry, but, you know, anybody that gets some kind of government check is a freeloader to varying degrees. Anybody that gets any kind of a government check is a parasite. On the rest, you know, somebody has to work. Because ultimately, where does the food come from? Where do the goods and services come from? If you have people that don't work, and they're just kind of sitting around all day watching Oprah Winfrey or whatever it is they do, you know, and this even includes retirees that are getting government checks, where does it, you know, and they can make the argument, well, we paid into the system and we're entitled and blah, 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 blah. Be that as it may, where do the goods and services come from? Who's manufacturing the food you eat? Who's distributing the food you eat so that you can buy it at your local supermarket or wherever? Where's that coming from? Somebody has to do that. Somebody's having to work. And the bottom line is we're getting fewer, we've got more people that are just sitting there on their asses like birds, you know, like the baby birds in the nests, sitting there with their mouths poked straight up, waiting for mama to come along and put a worm in it. there's more people, there's a majority of people that aren't working now, that aren't doing anything. They're just sitting around waiting for someone else to bring them, you know, to manufacture the food for them and to bring it to them. At the same time, they're trying to, you know, they're supporting people and trying to make things that are making things worse, that are breaking the system even further. This insanity has to stop. You know, if you've got kids, thank God I don't, but if you've got kids, they have no future. If you have kids, they face a bleak future. You know, I was thinking the other day, you know, you remember back, you know, year 2000, you know, and everybody was all upset about, you know, the year 2000 and computers, and things were just going to come to a grinding halt because all these computers didn't have, you know, the four digits for the year 2000. They just had, you know, they put, you know, a lot of computer programs, older computer programs, they just put into, you know, like 89, 90, or, you know, 75, 65, whenever they were written, they just put in the last two digits for the year. And so there were people that were predicting this big calamity. And of course, a lot of companies did spend a lot of money fixing the problem before it really happened. A lot of corporations and, you know, probably government and what have you, they spent a lot of money on, you know, retooling those programs in order to fix the problem. So when, you know, but it, you know, people were all concerned that it was going to be the computers were going to fail and what have you. Well, you know, if an apocalypse comes, you know, if Armageddon comes or just some sort of apocalypse, forget about Armageddon. If an apocalypse comes, you know, and you know, when if machines break down, what do people do? They fix them. You know, but if there's some kind of an apocalypse or some sort of hell, you know, because basically we're talking some sort of hell breaking loose, that doesn't come from machines breaking down. Where does it come from? There's, you know, you can have a natural disaster, but those are usually only temporary. And, you know, you get over them, you recover from them. Or where's the other thing? Where does it come from? It's people. Dysfunctional people. People that are made dysfunctional. And by golly, we've been producing a hell of a lot of dysfunctional people. Just as many as the government can produce. And we're at the point now where the shit has hit the fan. It's not just a threat now. It has hit the fan. You know, and pardon my French, but the shit, you know, we either better shit or get off the pot. We either straighten it out or not. Because an increasing amount of hell is about to be released into the world. If the apocalypse comes, it comes from primarily from people. From people being dysfunctional. And if you want an idea of what that is, you know, how bad can it be? You know, pick some country, some third world country, you know, where things have really gone wrong, you know, like Darfur or Hitler Germany it's happened over and over again. Pick some country, and you know, where, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people get slaughtered, and you'll see that hell, you know, hell was released. Where does hell come from? It comes out of people. It comes from dysfunctional people. So when we tolerate dysfunction from people, we tolerate it, or we, you know, we don't want, we're afraid of, oh, we don't want to hurt people's feelings, or we're afraid we're going to, they won't like us or something. Stupid. So you tolerate that and tolerate it 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 and tolerate it. And finally, it can't be tolerated anymore. Finally, the dysfunction gets so big and so bad that hell does break loose. And we're just about there. We really are just about there. You know, and at this point, it's pretty, I'd say it's pretty touch and go. I think with, you know, just look at what's happening well, you saw what happened in Egypt, and of course, our media just totally spun that to be something that it wasn't. You know, they've tried to say, oh, it's the people fighting for freedom. You know, well, what it ended up being a military coup. You know, we don't know how it's going to come out. You know, we don't know where, you know, what ultimately happens to Egypt. But in the meantime, this same phenomena is spreading to other countries in the Middle East. Very volatile region. We could easily end up with World War III. You know, and so in the meantime, the United States, you know, look at, we're in total disarray. Just absolute disarray. You know, if as I've said many times, you know, there's a percentage of people, and I don't know what the percentage is worldwide. I believe the percentage of people in the United States is from one-third to one-half, maybe upwards of one-half, of the population of the United States is, you know, they look like normal people, they may act like normal people, but when it comes right down to it, when push comes to shove, they respond to whatever the greatest pressure is. I don't know what the percentage of the, you know, world population, you know, if it's 6 billion people or what, let's say it's 6 billion people. Well, is it 3 billion of those people, 3 billion out of those 6 billion, are they, or is it even higher? Is it maybe 4 billion people just that are just basically programmed? They're not real. They're not real people. They don't have a genuine identity. I don't know what that percentage is, but it's a big percentage. It's probably at least half of the world population, probably 3 billion out of 6 billion people. If 6 billion is the world population, half of those people are not genuine people. They're just programmed. They're robots. They respond to whatever the greatest pressure is. So if the United States is not the greatest pressure, because we're not now, we're not the big pressure that we used to be, then who is? Then it descends into chaos. Then you have New Orleans. Then the world turns into New Orleans after Katrina. The world turns into inner city Detroit. The world turns into, you know, inner city New York City. Or the world turns into Darfur. You know, and as I've said before, you know, it's like here comes the meteor. The meteor is about to strike the earth, and you know, you got some idiot there that, oh, I don't want to know about that. I want to polish my car. I want my car to look good. I don't want to pay attention to reality. People are, you know, locked into their little selfish worlds, their little fantasy lands that are meaningless, that are utterly meaningless. But But I really do think that, you know, we potentially face World War III, and it may be a hell of a lot sooner than we think. I'm just saying. So, anyway, how long have we been going? Whoops, wrong thing I clicked on. Let's see here. Okay, we've been going about 40 minutes. I've got a commencement address by Ronald Reagan. This is from 1981, Notre Dame. He gave the commencement address. And so this is about 27 minutes roughly. And so that'll kind of round out the podcast. So let's listen to A Voice of Sanity. This is Ronald Reagan, 1981 Notre Dame commencement speech.
Great gratitude for what he has done today, coming to us for the very first time out of Washington after his terrible accident. May I present to you Dr. Ronald Reagan, the President of the United States of America.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Father Hesburgh, I thank you very much, and for so many things. The distinguished honor that you've conferred upon me here today, I must say, however, compounds a sense of guilt that I have nursed for almost 50 years. I thought the first degree I was given was honorary. But it's wonderful to be here today with Governor Orr, Governor Bowen, Senators Lugar and Quayle and Representative Hyler. These distinguished honorees, the trustees, administration, faculty, students, and friends of Notre Dame, and most important, the graduating class of 1981. Nancy and I are greatly honored to share this day with you, and our pleasure has been more than doubled because I am also sharing the platform with a longtime and very dear friend, Pat O'Brien. Pat and I haven't been able to see much of each other lately, so I haven't had a chance to tell him that there is now another tie that binds us together. Until a few weeks ago, I knew very little about my father's ancestry. He had been orphaned at age 6. But now I've learned that his grandfather, my great-grandfather, left Ireland to come to America, leaving his home in Ballyporeen, a village in County Tipperary in Ireland. And I have learned that Ballyporeen is the ancestral home of the O'Briens. Now, if I don't watch out, this may turn out to be less of a commencement than a warm bath in nostalgic memories. Growing up in Illinois, I was influenced... I was influenced by a sports legend so national in scope that it was almost mystical. It is difficult to explain to anyone who didn't live in those times. The legend was based on a combination of three elements: a game, football, a university, Notre Dame, and a man, Canute Rockne. There's been nothing like it before or since. My first time to ever see Notre Dame was to come here as a sports announcer 2 years out of college to broadcast a football game. You won, or I wouldn't have mentioned that. A number of years later, I returned here in the company of Pat O'Brien and a galaxy of Hollywood stars for the world premiere of Canute Rockne All-American, in which I was privileged to play George Gipp. I've always suspected that there might have been many actors in Hollywood who could have played the part better, but no one could have wanted to play it more than I did. And I was given the part largely because the star of that picture, Pat O'Brien, kindly and generously held out a helping hand to a beginning young actor. Having come from the world of sports, I'd been trying to write a story about Canute Rockne. I must confess that I had someone in mind to play the Gipper. On one of my sports broadcasts before going to Hollywood, I had told the story of his career and tragic death. I didn't have very many words on paper when I learned that the studio that employed me was already preparing a story treatment for that film. And that brings me to the theme of my remarks. I'm the fifth president of the United States to address a Notre Dame commencement. The temptation is great to use this forum as an address on a great international or national issue that has nothing to do with this occasion. Indeed, this is somewhat traditional. So I wasn't surprised when I read in several reputable journals that I was going to deliver an address on foreign policy or on the economy. I'm not going to talk about either. But by the same token, I'll try not to belabor you with some of the standard rhetoric that is beloved of graduation speakers. For example, I'm not going to tell you that you know more today than you've ever known before or than you will ever know again. The other standby is, when I was 14, I didn't think my father knew anything. By the time I was 21, I was amazed at how much the old gentleman had learned in 7 years. And then, of course, the traditional and the standby is that a university like this is a storehouse of knowledge because the freshmen bring so much in and the seniors take so little away. You members of the graduating class of 1981, I don't really go back that far, are what behaviorists call achievers. And while you will look back with warm pleasure your memories of these years that brought you here to where you are today, you are also, I know, looking at the future that seems uncertain to most of you, but which, let me assure you, offers great expectations. Take pride in this day. Thank your parents, as one on your behalf has already done here. Thank those who've been of help to you over the last 4 years. And then do a little celebrating. You're entitled. This is your day, and whatever I say should take cognizance of that fact. It is a milestone in life, and it marks a time of change. Winston Churchill, during the darkest period of the Battle of Britain in World War II, said, "When great causes are on the move in the world, we learn we're spirit, not animal, and that something is going on in space and time and beyond space and time, which, whether we like it or not, spells duty." Now, I'm going to mention again that movie that Pat and I and Notre Dame were in, because it says something about America. First, that Canute Rockne, as a boy, came to America with his parents from Norway. And in the few years it took him to grow up to college age, he became so American that here at Notre Dame he became an All-American in a game that is still, to this day, uniquely American. As a coach, he did more than teach young men how to play a game. He believed truly that the noblest work of man was building the character of man. And maybe that's why he was a living legend. No man connected with football has ever achieved the stature or occupied the singular niche in the nation that he carved out for himself, not just in sport, but in our entire social structure. Now today, I hear very often, "Win one for the Gipper," spoken in a humorous vein. Lately, I've been hearing it by congressmen who are supportive of the programs that I've introduced. But let's look at the significance of that story. Rockne could have used Gip's dying words to win a game anytime. But 8 years went by following the death of George Gipp before Rock revealed those dying words, his dead wish. And then he told the story at halftime to a team that was losing, and one of the only teams he had ever coached that was torn by dissension and jealousy and factionalism. The seniors on that team were about to close out their football careers without learning or experiencing any of the real values that the game has to impart. None of them had known George Gipp. They were children when he played for Notre Dame. It was to this team that Rockne told the story, and so inspired them that they rose above their personal animosities. For someone they had never known, they joined together in a common cause and attained the unattainable. We were told when we were making the picture of one line that was spoken by a player during that game, we were actually afraid to put it in the picture. The man who carried the ball over for the winning touchdown was injured on the play. We were told that as he was lifted on the stretcher, he carried off the field, he was heard to say, "That's the last one I can get for you, Gipper." Now, it's only a game, and maybe to hear it now afterward, and this is what we feared, it might sound maudlin and not the way it was intended. But is there anything wrong with young people having an experience, feeling something so deeply, thinking of someone else to the point that they can give so completely of themselves? There will come times in the lives of all of us when we'll be faced with causes bigger than ourselves, and they won't be on a playing field. This nation was born when a band of men, the Founding Fathers, a group so unique we've never seen their like since, rose to such selfless heights. Lawyers, tradesmen, merchants, farmers, 56 men, achieved security and standing in life, but valued freedom more. They pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. 16 of them gave their lives, most gave their fortunes, all preserved their sacred honor. They gave us more than a nation. They brought to all mankind for the first time the concept that man was born free, that each of us has inalienable rights, ours by the grace of God, and that government was created by us for our convenience, having only the powers that we choose to give it. Now, this is the heritage that you're about to claim as you come out to join the society made up of those who've preceded you by a few years, or some of us by a great many. This experiment in man's relation to man is a few years into its third century. Saying that may make it sound quite old, but let's look at it from another viewpoint or perspective. A few years ago, someone figured out that if you could condense the entire history of life on Earth into a motion picture that would run for 24 hours a day, 365 days, maybe on leap years we could have an intermission, this idea that is the United States wouldn't appear on the screen until 3.5 seconds before midnight on December 31st. And in those 3.5 seconds, not only would a new concept of society come into being, a golden hope for all mankind, but more than half the activity, economic activity in world history, would take place on this continent. Free to express their genius, individual Americans, men and women, in 3.5 seconds, would perform such miracles of invention, construction, and production as the world had never seen. As you join us out there beyond the campus, you know there are great unsolved problems. Federalism, with its built-in checks and balances, has been distorted. Central government has usurped powers that properly belong to local and state governments. And in so doing, in many ways, that central government has begun to fail to do the things that are truly the responsibility of a central government. All of this has led to the misuse of power and preemption and prerogatives of people in their social institutions. You are graduating from a great private, or if you will, independent university. Not too many years ago, such schools were relatively free from government interference. In recent years, government has spawned regulations covering virtually every facet of our lives. The independent and church-supported colleges and universities have found themselves enmeshed in that network of regulations and the costly blizzard of paperwork that government has demanded. 34 congressional committees and almost 80 subcommittees have jurisdiction over 439 separate laws affecting education at the college level alone. Almost every aspect of campus life is now regulated. Hiring, firing, promotions, physical plant, construction, record keeping, fundraising, and to some extent, curriculum and educational programs. I hope when you leave this campus that you will do so with a feeling of obligation to your alma mater. She'll need your help and support in the years to come. If ever the great independent colleges and universities like Notre Dame give way to and are replaced by tax-supported institutions, the struggle to preserve academic freedom will have been lost. And we're troubled today by economic stagnation brought on by inflated currency and prohibitive taxes and burdensome regulations. The cost of stagnation, in human terms, mostly among those least equipped to survive it, is cruel and inhuman. Now, after those remarks, don't decide that you'd better turn your diploma back in so you can stay another year on the campus. I've just given you the bad news. The good news is that something is being done about all this, because the people of America have said enough already. You know, we who had preceded you had just gotten so busy that we let things get out of hand. We forgot that we were the keepers of the power, forgot to challenge the notion that the state is the principal vehicle of social change, forgot that millions of social interactions among free individuals and institutions can do more to foster economic and social progress than all the careful schemes of government planners. Well, at last, we're remembering that government has certain legitimate functions which it can perform very well, that it can be responsive to the people, that it can be humane and compassionate, but that when it undertakes tasks that are not its proper province, it can do none of them as well or as economically as the private sector. For too long, government has been fixing things that aren't broken and inventing miracle cures for unknown diseases. We need you. We need your youth. We need your strength. We need your idealism to help us make right that which is wrong. Now, I know that this period of your life, you have been and are critically looking at the mores and customs of the past and questioning their value. Every generation does that. May I suggest, don't discard the time-tested values upon which civilization was built simply because they're old. More important, don't let today's doom-criers and cynics persuade you that the best is past, that from here on it's all downhill. Each generation sees farther than the generation that preceded it because it stands on the shoulders of that generation. You're going to have opportunities beyond anything that we've ever known. The people have made it plain already. They want an end to excessive government intervention in their lives and in the economy, an end to the burdensome and unnecessary regulations, and a punitive tax policy that does take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. They want a government that can not only continue to send men across the vast reaches of space and bring them safely home, but that can guarantee that you and I can walk in the park or our neighborhood after dark and get safely home. And finally, they want to know that this nation has the ability to defend itself against those who would seek to pull it down. And all of this, we the people can do. Indeed, a start has already been made. There's a task force under the leadership of the Vice President, George Bush, that is to look at those regulations I've spoken of. They have already identified hundreds of them that can be wiped out with no harm to the quality of life. And the cancellation of just those regulations will leave billions and billions of dollars in the hands of the people for productive enterprise and research and development and the creation of jobs. The years ahead are great ones for this country, for the cause of freedom and the spread of civilization. The West won't contain communism. It'll transcend communism. It won't bother to dismiss or denounce it. It will dismiss it as some bizarre chapter in human history whose last pages are even now being written. William Faulkner, at a Nobel Prize ceremony some time back, said, "Man would not only endure, he will prevail against the modern world because he will return to the old verities and the truths of the heart." And then Faulkner said of man, "He is immortal because he alone among creatures has a soul, a spirit capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance." One can't say those words, compassion, sacrifice, and endurance, without thinking of the irony that one who so exemplifies them, Pope John Paul II, a man of peace and goodness and inspiration to the world, would be struck by a bullet from a man towards whom he could only feel compassion and love. It was Pope John Paul II who warned in last year's in his encyclical on mercy and justice against certain economic theories that use the rhetoric of class struggle to justify injustice. He said, "In the name of an alleged justice, the neighbor is sometimes destroyed, killed, or deprived of liberty, or stripped of fundamental human rights." For the West, for America, the time has come to dare to show to the world that our civilized ideas, our traditions, our values are not like the ideology and war machine of totalitarian societies, just a facade of strength. It is time for the world to know our intellectual and spiritual values are rooted in the source of all strength, a belief in a supreme being and a law higher than our own. When it's written, history of our time won't dwell long on the hardships of the recent past. But history will ask, and our answer determine the fate of freedom for 1,000 years. Did a nation born of hope lose hope? Did a people forged by courage find courage wanting? Did a generation steeled by hard war and a harsh peace forsake honor at the moment of great climactic struggle for the human spirit? If history asks such questions, it also answers them. And the answers are to be found in the heritage left by generations of Americans before us. They stand in silent witness to what the world will soon know and history someday record. That in the 3rd century, the American nation came of age, affirmed its leadership of free men and women, serving selflessly a vision of man with God, government for people, and humanity at peace. You know, a few years ago, an Australian Prime Minister, John Gordon, said, "I wonder if anybody ever thought what the situation for the comparatively small nations in the world would be if there were not in existence the United States, if there were not this giant country prepared to make so many sacrifices. This is the noble and rich heritage rooted in great civil ideas of the West, and it is yours. My hope today is that in the years to come, and come it shall, to explain to, when it's your time, to explain to another generation the meaning of the past and thereby hold out to them their promise of the future, that you'll recall the truths and traditions of which we've spoken. It is these truths and traditions that define our civilization and make up our national heritage. And now they're yours to protect and pass on. I have one more hope for you. When you do speak to the next generation about these things, that you will always be able to speak of an America that is strong and free. To find in your hearts an unbounded pride in this much-loved country, this once and future land, this bright and hopeful nation whose generous spirit and great ideals the world still honors. Congratulations and God bless you."
Okay, so there was Ronald Reagan. I cut the applause off because that goes for like another 45 seconds. That was Ronald Reagan giving a commencement address at Notre Dame in 1981. And as he always did in his speeches, he educated people. You know, amazing. You know, I could just listen to him 24/7. He was absolutely brilliant. Just amazing. So, and you could listen to that. That was in 1981. Of course, that was after he had been elected president following the Carter debacle, Jimmy Carter, the Jimmy Carter presidency. And you could listen to that and apply that to today's politics. You know, he's talking about people being fed up. Well, I think we're there again. You know, so, you know, it kind of happened all over again. You know, and I think people tend to get complacent. And of course, each generation, I think, comes along and has to learn a lesson. And that's especially true if the parents don't teach them. And, you know, so, I don't know. In any case, you know, I love listening to him, and as I say, I could listen to him 24/7, and you know, because he's just a wealth. You know, you just listen to one of these speeches, and he's just a wealth of knowledge. It's amazing. So, anyhow, probably better be cutting this off. Get to bed, and then I can get up and get out of here tomorrow and get on up towards Springfield, Ohio. So anyhow, hope everyone has a great weekend, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.